Okay, I want to thank Rabbi Yasgur for hosting me here today and for such a warm welcome. It's much more than a partnership. It really is much more of a symbiotic relationship than he was kind enough to suggest. And really, when I come to speak here, it's really like being in my own shul. I know so many of the faces here between our Tuesday morning classes, between our Wednesday kollel, between all the various learning that take place over at BRS, the number of times that either Rabbi Brody or Rabbi Goldberg or I will come and speak here. And so in many ways, this is an extension of our shul and our family. And it's really wonderful and nice to be here. And I thank you very much for inviting me. I just want to acknowledge two people before I start. First of all, my dear friend, Larry Stern, his son Jay, who's joining us here today. I don't know how many, Larry, raise your hand. I don't know how many people here know Larry Stern. But my guess is that here in Century Village, Larry Stern is another Jew. He's someone who sits in the back, minds his own business. But from my personal experiences, I could tell you that Larry is much more than that. He's been a personal mentor to me for a number of years, having worked with Larry in Camp Masorah for a bunch of years. Jay and I made some trouble together in Camp Masorah for a bunch of years. But I want to thank Larry for being here and for your friendship. And I look forward to working together on many other projects. You should have a complete refuah shleima. You should only feel good, Larry. I also want to welcome my sister's in-laws, Marty and Joel Walensky. So wonderful to see you guys, and I'm glad they allowed you in the door, even though you didn't weren't able to respond on time. But as I always say to people who know my family, whether you like what I'm saying or not, tell my sister I was good. That's all you have to do. Just tell her I was good. Give my sister a little nachas, because God knows I pester her enough. Okay, by a show of hands, who here has ever read The Merchant of Venice? Okay. Who here remembers reading The Merchant of Venice? Exactly, a little bit. Seventh grade, I read it in seventh grade. I don't know when you read it. And the truth is, I hadn't read it since seventh grade. But this year marks the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death. And all around the world, they are marking this occasion in a variety of different ways, through lectures, through classes, through performances. And as I was looking at this whole slew of calendar events marking this occasion, it occurred to me, why don't we look at Shakespeare and his life from a Jewish lens and see what was his enduring, everlasting impact, not just on literature and not just on how we perceive so much of the world through his eyes, but how do we perceive Judaism? And what I want to do is take you down a road that many of you are probably unfamiliar with and will be somewhat surprising to you. And that is to realize to this very day, in, I think I'll count, seven different examples, Shakespeare's play of Merchant of Venice directly influences halachic decisions, Jewish law, and our interpretation of Jewish law. Now, I could tell you with 100% certainty that if Shakespeare were sitting right here, and I told him that 400 years after his death, Jewish scholars from around the world who have never read a word of Shakespeare would be analyzing his play, Merchant of Venice, he would laugh in my face. And the reason why he would laugh in my face is because for those of you who read it, even if it was in the distant past, you'll remember that part of the calling card, part of the legacy of The Merchant of Venice is its anti-Semitic portrayal of the Jewish people. There's arguably no greater mainstream text. Obviously, you have the Elders of Zion, but there's no greater mainstream text that has done a better job of creating a negative stereotype of the Jewish people as Shakespeare was able to accomplish in his play Merchant of Venice. And scholars for the last 400 plus years have debated whether Shakespeare did that on purpose, whether he knew what he was getting himself into. Most scholars argue that Shakespeare never met a Jew in his entire life, right? The Jewish people were kicked out of England about 300 years prior to Shakespeare writing The Merchant of Venice. Even if he met a Jew, it definitely wasn't a religious Jew, it wasn't a practicing Jew. And so Shakespeare called for a number of different places this stereotype of the negativity of what a Jew resembles. Remember, interest, conniving, stealing, all of these types of things, and Shakespeare put it together into one play. He likely did it to sell tickets, right? The negative portrayal of Jews is what probably allowed him to sell tickets and to popularize it. And that's always what I thought The Merchant of Venice was about, and the everlasting legacy of The Merchant of Venice in Shakespeare, in my mind, was always that negative portrayal of what it is to be a Jew. And again, arguably no greater mainstream text has done a better job of creating and fostering anti-Semitism than Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice. However, there's another side to that equation. Again, and this is the side that I think Shakespeare would find very funny. And that is that we, to this day, use The Merchant of Venice and Shakespeare's negative portrayal of the central character in Merchant of Venice to adjudicate halachic law, to adjudicate Jewish law. And that is what I want to talk to you just a little bit about for this afternoon. Let's do a brief run-through. For those of us who haven't read it in 1 or 2 years, let's do a brief run-through of what takes place in The Merchant of Venice. Of course, the play opens up with Bassanio, who is a Venetian individual, and he's looking for a certain amount of money because he wants to travel. He's trying to get the girl. He's trying to get someone, a wealthy heiress named Portia. So one problem, he doesn't have the money. And so he goes to his dear friend Antonio, and he says, Antonio, can you lend me some money? Antonio says, I'd love to lend you money. There's one problem. All of my assets are tied up. Remember, it's tied up on boats that are currently at sea. And so therefore, because it's not liquid, he can't give him the money. But he goes, I know there's someone in town who will oftentimes lend money. Let's go see the Jew whose name is Shylock. And so Antonio and Bassanio, they go to Shylock. Shylock hates Antonio, as we'll see, and I'll read a couple of excerpts in a second. And Shylock says, I'll give you the loan that you're looking for, but here's the deal. Again, for those of you who remember, if you don't pay me back, what is the repercussion? A pound of flesh. Now, obviously, that's ludicrous, and it's filled with humor, and it's written to show just how evil and wicked Shylock can be. But Antonio and Bassanio, they're desperate for the money, and so they say, okay, you got a deal. You give us the money. If we can't pay it back on time, I'll give you a pound of flesh. Meanwhile, Bassanio, he goes to Portia, he goes to this island, and he gets called back, and he comes back with Portia, who's now dressed up in someone else. And something happens. There's a delay in Antonio's boats coming back, and they are unable to pay the loan on time. And in a very ironic turn of events, Shylock takes them to court, and Portia, who is the judge, she's the duchess, if you remember it, right? So she's the judge of the court case, and she says, okay, you got to pay him back. There's one caveat. And the caveat is you can only take a pound of flesh, nothing more. Now I ask you, try cutting a pound of flesh from me and nothing else. Well, I was going to say, sound like my mother, okay? Right? Try taking a pound of flesh, okay? Try taking a pound of flesh and nothing more. It's impossible. Why? Because we're human beings. We bleed and things aren't exact as a pound of flesh. And so she says, and if you take anything more than a pound of flesh, then you're going to be in a lot of trouble, because harming unduly a Christian in Venice was a capital punishment. It would not work out well for Shylock. And so Shylock realizes he's backed against the wall. He ultimately capitulates. He has to give over all of his money. And everyone is happy. Antonio's happy. Bassanio's happy. Portia's happy. I didn't mention Lorenzo and Jessica, right? Shylock's daughter intermarries. Everyone's happy at the end of the play, except for Shylock. In the 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century, a rabbi by the name of Rav Yosef Shlomo Zevin. Okay, now we know Rav Zevin. How do we know Rav Zevin? From Israel, right? Rav Zevin was the editor-in-chief of the Encyclopedia Talmudit, a major Torah scholar, and he wondered the following question. Would the deal that Shylock and Antonio cut, the pound of flesh, would that have held up in a Jewish court of law? If the two of them, instead of going to a Venetian court, if the two of them had come to a Jewish court of law, who would have come out on top? And that's going to be the million-dollar question for us today. To get there, I just want to read for you a couple of excerpts from Merchant of Venice. And I do so to give you just a little bit of a flavor for just how anti-Semitic the work is. In Act 1, Scene 3, we're introduced to Shylock. And Shylock says the following when he sees Antonio come into the door. He says, "How like a fawning publican he looks. I hate him for he is Christian. But more for that, and in low simplicity, he lends out money gratis and brings down the rate of usurance here with us in Venice." Antonio hates, Shylock hates him for no other reason than he's a Christian and he undermines his business. "If I catch him once upon the hip, I will feed fat the ancient grudge I bear him. He hates our sacred nation and he rails. Even there where merchants most do congregate, oh me, my bargains and my well-won thrift, which he calls, quote-unquote, interest. Cursed be my tribe if I forgive him." Again, presents a very negative image. Why does he hate him? Because he's different, because he's a Christian, because he undermines my business dealings. Finally, we have Shylock cuts the deal with Antonio. He says, "This kindness I will show you." Right? Again, Antonio's coming to him with a very innocuous request. He needs money to help Bassanio get the girl. How much more romantic does it get than that? And so Shylock responds, "I'll do you this favor. If you repay me not on such a day, in such a place, such a sum, in sums as are expressed in the condition, let the forfeit be nominated for an equal pound of your fair flesh, to be cut off and taken in what part of your body pleaseth me." To which Antonio responds, "And say there is much kindness in the Jew." Right? In other words, this is how you treat people. This is how they call Jews so kind. So again, Shakespeare over and over and over again builds up that negative impression, that negative stereotype of what it means to be a Jew. Even perhaps the most famous lines of the entire play by Shylock is anti-Semitic. I'll read you the line and then I'll show you why it's anti-Semitic. You'll recognize the line as very famously. "Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions?" Right? In other words, I'm the same as everyone else. "If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die?" Right? So again, so far you're like, oh, he's humanizing Shylock. Shakespeare's doing us a favor. There's only one problem. What's the context of that speech? The context of that speech is Shylock rationalizing why he wants revenge. He says, "I'm just like you. If anyone wronged you, you would want revenge. A Jew is no different. And so I want revenge for the sake of having revenge." And again, I can read you excerpt after excerpt after excerpt of where Shakespeare creates this very negative portrayal, a very negative and harmful stereotype for what it means to be a Jew. Let's come back to our pound of flesh. Would this hold up in a Jewish court or law or not? What do you guys think? No. Why not? Aver minachai. What does that mean? That means he can't eat it. No one's asking Shylock to eat the pound of flesh. He just wants to take it because he's vindictive. He has a vengeful side to him. So mutilation is not acceptable. Right? We don't believe that you can harm your body for no sake or that you can harm anyone else's body for no purpose whatsoever. Okay, so it's mutilation. And therefore, no. And therefore, so even though they cut this deal, if you were the judge and they brought this deal before you, Shylock lends the money, Antonio promises the pound of flesh, you would say no deal. And your answer would be, the reason why it's no deal is because you can't actualize the deal were it to come to fruition. In other words, were Antonio not to be able to pay back, Shylock couldn't take the pound of flesh because it's against the Torah. And because the repercussions would be against the Torah, the whole deal is off. There's one problem with that. And you actually anticipated exactly how Rav Zevin starts his entire article. Rav Zevin's article is called Mishpat Shylock, which means Shylock's judgment. And again, I think Shakespeare would find it hysterical that a rabbi in Yerushalayim at the beginning of the 20th century wrote an entire essay just about analyzing Merchant of Venice from a Jewish perspective. And so Rav Zevin starts off exactly as you said. You might think that this deal would never even have happened because Shylock couldn't carry out the judgment even if he wanted to. The problem with that is, and Rav Zevin quotes, I think, six examples. I'll spare you five of them. I'll share with you one. Where even though we can't follow through on the punishment, the deal nonetheless holds true. So for example, I'll give you an example. Let's take the example of interest, for those who are doing Daf Yomi. So you're nauseated by the word interest by this point. We just finished Ezo Neshech and Bav Metzia. Right? For those, so let's say I lend Rabbi Yazger on interest. Right, Rabbi Yazger needs $100. I say, I'll give you the $100, but I want $120 back. He says, you know what? It's a bargain, right? The guy down the street wants $140. I'll take the deal. Who violates the prohibition? Both of us, right? Rabbi Yazger can't give interest. I can't take interest. Rav Zevin points out that halachically, from a Jewish perspective, though, the deal still goes through. In other words, even though he can't give it, he can't take it, he can't give it, and I can't take it, nonetheless, the transaction would be upheld. We would just violate a prohibition in the process of that. And so that's just one example where even though there's a prohibition attached to it, it doesn't undermine the essence of the transaction that was taking place. And so in our case, even though Shylock would be prohibited from actually taking the pound of flesh, nonetheless, the transaction would still be valid. And so Rav Zevin says, let's put that off to the side. And then he brings a different proof. And this is his thesis, which again, I'm going to show you, has been used countless times to this very day. Rav Zevin makes the following suggestion based on a comment by the Lubavitcher Rebbe in the Baal HaTanya. Okay? And he writes the following. I'm going to read you a couple lines in Hebrew, but I'll translate everything. He says, "Koach ha'chaim shel guf ha'adam, einenu shelo." That a person does not own his or her body. I don't own my body. My body is on loan from Hashem, which means I take care of that which God lent me, but it doesn't belong to me. He says, "Hashem natan ve'Hashem lakach." Anyone who's been to a funeral knows that's one of the last lines we say at a funeral. Right, as part of Tzedakah Din, the Lord has given and the Lord has taken. So listen to what he says. He says, "Einena melitza shel tanchum in gereda." That's not just a nice thing that rabbis say to make people feel good at a funeral. Ela shezohi hagdarat hametziut. He says that is really what it means to be a human being, what it means to be a Jew. God gave us our body; He lent it to us for God willing, 120 years, and then Hashem lakach, and then God's going to take it back. Natan HaKadosh Baruch Hu et Chaim LaAdam Sheishtamesh Bahem. God gave us our physical bodies so that we should use it. Aval lo sheyu kanuyim lo la'asos bahem ka'adam ha'otze b'toch shelo. But not that I could do whatever I want with it. Right? You and I both know that when you give someone something, it's theirs. They could do whatever they want with it. When you lend someone something, you want it back in good condition. So when Hashem lends us, when Hashem gives us the usability to our body for 120 years, Hashem wants it back on His terms. He wants it back in good condition. When you rent your apartment to someone, so there are certain stipulations on what the person can and cannot do in their apartment. For me, the number one stipulation would be no dogs. Everything else is secondary. No animals in my apartment, right? But even a service animal, I wouldn't rent to you. Find someone else, right? So again, everyone has their thing. But why? Why don't I want dogs? Why don't I want cats? Because I don't want dogs and cats in my apartment. So I give it to you. I'm renting it to you. I'm giving it. I'm lending it to you. But I want it back under the terms. I want it back in the good condition under the terms that I am comfortable with. And so says Rav Zevin, that is what it means. Hashem natan ve'Hashem lakach. God gave us our body. He didn't give it to us as a gift that we own our body, but rather He gave it to us to use. Lakachta es hachayim bechazara efshar rak lemi shenasnam laKadosh Baruch Hu v'lo laAdam atzmo. Einenu bal habayit. We are not the owners over our body; we are the caretakers over our body. And therefore, he says at the conclusion of this 20-page essay, Hachoze Shylock Antonio's who? Right? If you brought the Shylock Antonio deal in front of me, Lefi halacha, batel umivutal miikaro. It never would have started. Here's why it wouldn't have started, said Rezevin. Let's say, I'm going to pick on Rabbi, can I pick on you again?
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to pick on Rabbi Yasker again. Okay? Let's say I go over to my dear friend, Larry Stern. And I say, Larry, I got a deal of the century for you. I don't know what apartments here go for. But let's say $10,000. You give me $10,000, I'll give you Rabbi Yasker's apartment.
I'll pay 50.
So Larry's going to say, that's a deal. So he's going to give me the $10,000. He's going to show up at Rabbi Yasker's door, 10 o'clock at night, knock on the door and say, Rabbi, I'm here for my apartment. Rabbi Yasker is quickly going to dial 911 with one hand as he's closing the door with the other hand, right? What are you, crazy, Larry? You're in my house, 10 o'clock. I never gave you my apartment. He says, you didn't give it to me. But I gave Philip Moskowitz $10,000. He said I could have your apartment. So we go to court. Judge is sitting there. Larry sets out the deal that he and I made. And the judge looks at us and says, you're all a bunch of crazies, right?
It's true.
You, it happens to be true. You can't, me, Philip Moskowitz, I can't give away something that doesn't belong to me. Nor can I tell Larry, you know what? Here's $10,000. Hire a painter and show up at the Yasgers and do a paint job on their apartment. Why can't I? It doesn't belong to me. Right? The only one who can do that is Rabbi Yasker himself. And so says Rav Zevin, that is exactly what happens in the deal between Shylock and Antonio. Shylock comes to Antonio and says, here's the money that you need, and if you don't pay me back, I want the pound of flesh. God says back to Shylock, so to speak, who are you to give away someone else's body? Who are you to make a deal with someone else's apartment? It doesn't belong to you, it belongs to me. Only I can make the deal over what happens to a person's body. You're the caretaker. You have to do a good job of caring for your body, so you have to exercise and eat right and sleep right. But at the end of the day, only I, God, get to make the decisions about what happens to Antonio's body. And so therefore, says Rav Zevin, batel umivutal meikaro. The deal never would have been happening. He says it's a ludicrous deal because it's the equivalent of me making a deal with Larry Stern over Rabbi Yasker's apartment. It's absurd. And so he says from a Jewish perspective as well, because Antonio doesn't own his body, he's simply the caretaker over his body, it's as if the deal never happened whatsoever. Okay? And he finishes up with a line that we say from Slichos, which was also in the distant past, but maybe some of you remember it. We say, Haneshama lach ve'aguf palach. Haneshama lach ve'aguf shalach. We say, Hashem, the neshama, our souls belong to you, and our bodies belong to you. And he finishes the last three words, Kinyan shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It belongs to God. We are simply the caretakers over. Now that in and of itself is fascinating. To this day, I would love to meet Rav Zevin and to ask him what inspired him to write an entire essay about a play that existed, 300 years before him. I don't know the answer to that. But the chiddush, the novel approach of Rav Zevin is astounding. We don't own our bodies, we're only the caretakers of it. Now let me give you some examples of where this applies itself practically to this very day. Most famously, it applies itself in a famous case from October 1953, long before I was a dream in my parents' eyes, okay? Or that my parents were alive, actually, I don't know. October 12th, 1953. Jewish state, Israel is only 5 years old. A group of Arab terrorists in the Golan, in the northern part of Israel, they come into Israel, they kill Suzanne Kinyas and her two children by throwing a grenade into her house. Now this was just the infancy of the state of Israel, and Israel wanted to make it very clear that this would not be tolerated. This type of terrorist activity would not be tolerated whatsoever. And so Israel launches Operation Shoshana. which was led by someone who is very well known to us. Anyone want to guess? Ariel Sharon. Ariel Sharon leads Operation Shoshana to take vengeance, so to speak, against what happened and to let the Arabs know that this would not be tolerated. And in that one operation, 69 Palestinians were murdered, 45 houses were burned, a school was burned, and a mosque was destroyed. It is commonly known no longer as Operation Shoshana, but as the Kibbeh massacres. Okay? Now, as you can imagine, there was an international uproar after that. It was really the first time Israel had to grapple with the concept of civilian casualties and how we were going to relate to civilian casualties. There's a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli, who at the beginning of the 20th century, or in the middle of the 20th century, excuse me, wrote an article about the idea of civilian casualties. And he postulates the following idea. He says that civilian casualties are acceptable for the following reason. When two countries, America and China, when they go to war with each other, America and Russia, when they go to war with each other, there's an international agreement, so to speak, that if we go to war, there are rules by how we're going to engage each other in war. And part of that is the expectation that civilians might die in the process. Now we, says Rav Yisraeli, unbeknownst to us, because we're citizens of the United States and we vote on representatives and senators and a president who makes these decisions, we therefore also agree to this international, so to speak, way of doing business, way of engaging each other in war. And so by being a member, by being a citizen of the United States of America, by proxy, so to speak, I allow America to go to war with other countries and recognize that the same way we might kill some of their civilians, I myself am also at risk. That is what's called in his language, I am mochel. I have the ability to, so to speak, give up on my right to for safety and security, and I trust the president to make those decisions on my behalf. Now that is a fundamental shift from what we just articulated from Rav Zevin. Because Rav Zevin would argue that you cannot make that decision. I'm not in control of my body. I'm not in control to say, I give you the right to go to war and therefore put me in harm's way. Rav Yisraeli fundamentally disagrees with Rav Zevin and says, no, that as human beings, when God gives you the ownership, when he gives you the rights to your body, it means within the confines of halacha, of Jewish law, you can do with it whatever you want. And so one example where this was an explosion of discussion was surrounding the idea of civilian casualties in the aftermath of the Kibbeh massacres. And if you read any article, Hebrew, English, about the notion of civilian casualties and analyzing it from a halachic perspective, first and foremost, you will see Rav Zevin in his discussion about the Merchant of Venice, and you will see Rav Yisraeli's response to that essay. I'll give you another example. Organ donation. Are you allowed to donate your organs while you're kind of still alive, kind of not alive? Are you allowed to mutilate your body like that? Any article, I'm not poskening halacha right now. All I'm telling you is that any article that you read on organ donation, right at the beginning, is going to be a mention of this idea of Rav Zevin in his discussion of Shylock and Antonio. Again, unbelievably ironic. If you think, if Shakespeare were to have known that his play was being used for this purposes to this very day. I'll give you another example. How about cosmetic surgery? Optional cosmetic surgery. Do I have control over my body or do I not? I'll read you an essay from Rabbi Yitzchak Breidowitz. This was on a conference in Jewish medical ethics in 1996 in San Francisco. He writes the following. My body, he starts off his entire lecture. My body is not my own. It is the property of God who has entrusted it to me for care and preservation. Thus, the premise of the pro-choice movement that we have absolute control over our bodies is fundamentally flawed. There is even discussion in halachic literature concerning the permissibility of elective cosmetic surgery, both in terms of surgical risks and in terms of mutilation of God's property. Rabbi Shlomo Yosef Zevin wrote an article demonstrating that in The Merchant of Venice, Antonio's contract with Shylock to pay a pound of flesh is unenforceable under Jewish law. So again, you have all of these examples to this very day. Abortion, cosmetic surgery, organ donation. Here's an article about body piercing, where the writer writes, this is Rabbi Chaim Steinmetz, who was recently hired as the rabbi of KJ in Manhattan. He writes, Jewish law prohibits one from hitting and wounding others. At first glance, this halacha is perplexing. It seems reasonable to prohibit someone from injuring another person when she protests. He says, why would halacha prohibit self-wounding? Why can't I hurt myself? He says, Shlomo Yosef Zevin answers that man is not the master over his own body. And lastly, an area of halacha, which is very relevant. So again, we spoke about organ donation, cosmetic surgery, abortion, body piercing. And the last is end-of-life issues. Who gets to make end-of-life issues? Here's an article that appeared in the RJJ Journal, the Journal of Halach and Contemporary Society, in fall 1996 by Rabbi Alfred Cohn. He writes here the following. One of the most painful and difficult experiences anyone has to go through is seeing a loved one suffering greatly. That feeling of helplessness, of suffering for a sick one, of despair, often lead one to ask, is this really necessary? Must a sick person suffer so much? Thus, in our age, which have seen marvels of medicine and surgery, develop machines which can breathe for a person, pump his blood, cleanse his arteries, and keep the body alive long after they would have hoped for release. More and more often, the question is asked, is this necessary? Is a person committed to Torah and Halacha obligated to do everything possible to prolong life? And then he says, and who decides? He quotes, the power of life over a person's body does not belong to him. Not only is a person forbidden to destroy his life, but even his life is not his in any way. And then he quotes Rav Zevin. And so I tried to give you, without going too much into each particular case, just a snapshot over how Rav Zevin's article about Shakespeare's writings continues to influence Jewish law and halachic decisions to this very day. And so when I think about the legacy of William Shakespeare, you ask anyone, 9 out of 10 people on the street, the legacy is going to be one of anti-Semitism. The Merchant of Venice promoted a horrific impression of Jews and the Jewish people as conniving and stealing and vicious. But ironically, and again, I think Shakespeare would be rolling in his grave now to know this, ironically, Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, the deal between Shylock and Antonio, continues to influence the way we perceive our relationship with Hashem, the way we perceive our relationship with our physical bodies, and the way we articulate and decide halachic questions to this very day. And in my mind, as a religious Jew, that continues to be the enduring legacy of William Shakespeare. So again, I thank you so much for inviting me here today. And I look forward to seeing you at future